The Parade of Phantoms book, written by Peter McCartney and published by Guildhall Press, contains 46 spine-tingling stories of paranormal folklore set in and around Derry. This Parade of Phantoms audiobook features 7 of these stories, narrated by Derry actors Pat Lynch, Micheál McDade, Tiernan McCartney and Sean Lusby. The Parade of Phantoms audiobook. Story 1. The Blacksmith and the Devil. Narrated by Pat Lynch.
Evil enters like a needle and spreads like an oak tree. Ethiopian proverb. For many years, Hard Street linked St. Columb's Wells to Long Tower Street on the edge of the Bogside area of the city. At the top of this street, there reputedly once stood a livery stable and a forge. The blacksmith who worked there was an addicted gambler and drinker. Every evening, men from the area, much to the annoyance of their wives, would gather in the stable to drink and play cards until the early hours of the morning. Invariably, the blacksmith would end up winning what little money they each had. Eventually, a group of angry wives pleaded with the parish priest to confront the smith and demand an end to his deplorable activities. The priest consented and made his way to the stable to challenge the blacksmith.
"I command you in the name of God to cease your odious gambling and drinking habits at once, or mark my words, dire consequences will surely befall you."
Unperturbed by the priest's ranting, the blacksmith countered mockingly,
"Ah, go to hell, priest, and mind your own business."
The priest trembled with anger and bellowed,
"How dare you? Don't you know you are doing the devil's work?"
"You know what, priest? If I were ever to meet the devil himself, I'd challenge him to a game of cards."
A priest crossed himself at the smith's blasphemy and left with a sombre warning.
"You shouldn't make such unholy statements. Be careful what you wish for."
Not long after, on a particularly stormy night, the blacksmith was in the stable drinking and playing cards alone. A sudden loud knock on the stable door startled him.
"Who the hell could that be in this damnable weather?"
However, thinking that it might be one of the locals come to gamble away their hard-earned cash, he hurried to answer it. The blacksmith opened the door and was confronted by a tall, lean man wearing a long black cloak, standing stony still. The man's gaunt face was deathly pale in colour, and a faint, eerie glow seemed to issue from his deep, sunken eyes. The smith felt very uneasy standing before this strange, intimidating figure. He curtly asked the nature of the stranger's visit. "What do you want?" The stranger quietly replied,
"I was hoping you might let me shelter from the storm and perhaps spare some food and drink. I have money I can pay."
The blacksmith, still feeling unsettled by the ghoulish appearance of the man, began making excuses.
It's late, I'm very tired. I was just about to go home and..."
The stranger interrupted.
"I see you play cards. Do you mind if I have a game?"
The smith's eyes immediately lit up, and smiling, he beckoned the stranger into the warmth of the stable. He produced a bottle of wine and some food, and after the stranger had eaten, they began to play cards. Within a short period of time, the blacksmith had won a large amount of money from the stranger and felt elated at his run of luck. They played for hours, and the more they played, the more he won. Eventually, the stranger made a suggestion. "Would you be up for doubling the stakes? Give me a chance to win back at least some of my losses." The blacksmith readily and gleefully agreed. After all, he was on a winning streak. He couldn't lose. As the game went on, however, it now became the stranger's turn to win. The smith's luck appeared to leave him completely, and he cursed and swore inwardly at his opponent's good fortune. He became very drunk and agitated, and bet his money rashly until, inevitably, he was left with nothing at all. The stranger then pushed all the money into the centre of the table and enticingly asked the blacksmith, "Are you willing to play one last hand? All or nothing?" Eager to recoup his losses, the smith asked, "What would you accept to cover such a large amount of money? The stable and the forge, perhaps?" The stranger shook his head in dissent. Then, staring at the smith, he uttered in a chilling voice, "I will only accept your immortal soul." Cold beads of sweat erupted on the blacksmith's forehead as the priest's words of warning now resounded in his mind. It was the devil incarnate he was playing cards with. The shock of this stark realization, however, lasted only momentarily. Without further thought or hesitation, he accepted the bet. The game was played, and the blacksmith lost. He was never seen nor heard of again after that night. When the locals were finally sure he would not be coming back, they set fire to the stable and forge. It is said that nothing has ever been built on that particular piece of ground since. And even today, some older residents of the bogside still talk warily of the blacksmith and the devil's card game. All or nothing.
The Parade of Phantoms audiobook. Story 2. The Demon Bride. Narrated by Pat Lynch and Shauna Losby.
The boundaries which divide life from death are at best shadowy and vague. Who shall say where the one ends and where the other begins? Edgar Allan Poe. A macabre tale of exorcism dating from the early 1940s was still common knowledge among the residents of Bishop Street over 50 years after the event. It centred on a two-room flat on the top story of a house in Lower Bishop Street. A newly married couple were urgently seeking a place to live, and in their desperation they reluctantly accepted this particular flat. The dwelling itself was in excellent condition, and both rooms had a window looking onto Bishop Street. Their reluctance to move in stemmed solely from rumours of ghostly and mysterious happenings associated with the premises. All the previous occupants were adamant in their belief that a strange, forbidding atmosphere seemed to pervade the smaller of the two rooms in the flat. many years before, this same room bore witness to a tragic event. The family who owned the house at the time had a daughter who was engaged to be married. One night, as she was trying on her wedding dress in the room, she became suddenly and violently ill. She was laid on top of a bed in the room, and a doctor and her fiancé were summoned. As the night progressed, her condition rapidly deteriorated. At one stage, she began tossing and turning and screeching.
"I won't die! I won't die! I'll be back! I'll be back!"
Just before dawn, the young bride-to-be died, still wearing her wedding dress. She was buried in the dress, and a few weeks after the funeral, the grief-stricken family moved out of the house. It was subsequently converted into flats. The latest occupants of the top floor flat found it very difficult to settle into their new surroundings. From the start, they decided not to use the smaller room at all, preferring instead to sleep, cook, and live in the one larger room. They were constantly troubled, however, by strange noises and movements coming from the empty, unused room, but were too fearful of entering it to discover the source of the unsettling disturbances. 10 months into their occupancy, the couple had a baby boy, and it was shortly after the birth that events in the flat reached a dramatic conclusion. One night, the young couple and child went out to visit some relatives, leaving the flat empty. Sometime later, a young woman was passing the house on the opposite side of the road and happened to look up at the window of the small room of the top flat. She saw a slim figure in a white dress beckoning her to come close. She couldn't quite make out the face of the figure and was somewhat taken aback at this strange sight. However, curiosity got the better of her and she crossed the street to have a closer look. Again, she looked up and there was the figure, still beckoning. Suddenly, the figure thrust its head forward right up against the window and the young girl reeled in horror as she saw a leering, evil face contorted in a malevolent, sneering grimace staring down at her. She fainted. Luckily, though, a passing policeman found her unconscious on the street. Carefully raising her to a sitting position, he revived the young woman.
"Are you okay, miss? What happened?"
She pointed fearfully to the top floor window. The policeman looked up and saw a girl in a wedding dress beckoning him forth. Thinking it must be someone in need of help, he rushed into the house and up to the top story. He knocked loudly on the door and called out,
"Are you all right in there? Do you need any help?"
Silence. He banged on the door again.
"Open this door. I need to check you're okay."
On getting no response, he forced the door open. He searched the flat carefully, but to his complete astonishment, found no one in either of the rooms. When the couple residing in the flat later returned, the events of that night were told to them. They decided it was time to contact their parish priest. On his way to work the next morning, the husband called at the parochial house. That same afternoon, a priest arrived at the flat. He listened intently to the story the young wife told him and immediately went to the cot where the child was lying. He lifted the child up and cradled him snugly but securely in his arms. He then asked for a candle to be lit and beseeched the young woman and her aunt, who was also there. "I want you both to begin praying aloud and on no account to be distracted by anything you might hear." He entered the small, uninviting room with the child and closed the door behind him. Instantly, the infant began to scream and cry, and an infernal disturbance could be heard coming from inside the room. The two women prayed fervently outside. Twenty minutes later, the door opened and the priest, cradling the still screaming child, stepped out. His coat was lying open and torn, as if an attempt had been made to forcefully remove it. His body was saturated with sweat and he was praying continuously. In this trance-like condition, he walked out of the flat, went down three steps to the upper landing window and without fear or hesitation, thrust his hand through one of the panes. At once, the child stopped screaming and the priest calmly instructed one of the women to find a piece of wood to cover the broken pane. The infant was returned to his cot and immediately fell soundly and peacefully asleep. The priest sat down exhausted and was given a cup of tea. He explained in a sombre, solemn tone. There was a fiendish presence in the room, but only the child could see it. He paused, gulped his tea and concluded. Regrettably, I only have the power to banish it temporarily. Heeding the priest's implied warning, the couple very soon afterwards left the diabolical abode. No one ever lived there again, and no one ever will, as the house has long since been demolished.
The Parade of Phantoms audiobook, Story 3, The Belmont Poltergeist, narrated by Pat Lynch, Micheál McDade, and Sean O'Lusby.
Her evil, tormented soul wreaked havoc on the living. M.H. Roberts. An abundance of documentation presently exists relating to what are termed poltergeists, disembodied spirits who never assume tangible shape. The phenomena are remarkably similar all over the world. Objects move unaided, doors open and close unassisted, light bulbs mysteriously flicker on and off, liquids boil inexplicably, and meaningless, unattributable noises occur. Often, for no known reason, a poltergeist will attach itself to a particular family or take possession of a specific house. This latter scenario appeared to have become all too frighteningly real for Tony and Geraldine, a married couple living in a house in the Belmont area of Derry. The manifestations began very subtly and very innocuously. The couple concerned decided to have the house completely renovated prior to moving in. Early each morning, the husband would go to the house to await the arrival of workmen. It was on a number of these occasions, before any workmen had actually arrived, that curiously puzzling incidents occurred. He would frequently notice a light on in a room, even though he had switched it off only minutes earlier. Or he would find doors which he had previously closed tightly, inexplicably opened. And often, for no apparent reason, the kettle in the kitchen would start boiling. At the time, he dismissed these happenings as simple oversights on his part. Eventually, the renovations were completed and the couple moved into the house. Within a matter of weeks, the husband began to experience a strange recurring phenomenon. Invariably, he would be awakened at around 6 o'clock in the morning by a particularly disquieting noise emanating from the loft. It sounded as though a heavy object was being dragged to and fro across the attic floor, and on each occasion, after barely a minute, it would abruptly cease. He checked the loft during the day at various intervals, but could never find anything to account for the unusual sounds. As these continuing incidents did not appear to disturb his wife, he decided to keep the events to himself and not worry her unnecessarily. At the end of their first year in the house, they celebrated the birth of their first child, Micheál. They took turns with the baby's early morning feeds, and after only a few weeks, the proud new mother anxiously broached the subject of a strange noise she had heard coming from the loft in the early hours of the morning.
Tony, can I talk to you about something?
What is it?
It's just... No, you're going to think I'm mad. Forget I said anything.
No, tell me. What is it?
Well, I was up early this morning, feeding Micheál.
Aye.
And I heard this, well, sound coming from the loft.
What kind of sound?
I can't really describe it. It's like something's being dragged around up there. Something heavy.
Aye, I've heard it.
What? You have?
Aye, I've been hearing it since the day we moved in, more or less. I've grown used to it by now.
Why didn't you say anything?
Well, look, I didn't want to worry you. I've been up there checking it all. There's nothing up there.
What do you think it is?
I couldn't tell you, Geraldine. But it's not doing us any harm, right? Maybe we should just leave it well alone.
Aye, maybe you're right.
Ominously, the couple's effective refusal to be intimidated by the noise in the loft appeared to antagonise whatever was perpetrating it. Overnight, it ceased completely. However, after only one night's respite, a more sinister, frightening phenomenon began. In the middle of each night, the silence of the slumbering house was now broken by the eerie sound of bare feet shuffling just outside the couple's bedroom door, then rapidly descending the stairs and entering the living room. On one occasion when they went down to the living room in the morning, they found that the pictures had been removed from the walls and arranged neatly on the fireside rug. They were at a complete loss for any rational explanation.
What is going on here, Tony?
I don't know, Geraldine. I really don't know.
One night, the husband was upstairs getting ready for bed. His wife was downstairs doing some last-minute tidying up. Suddenly, he heard her scream, a chilling, ear-splitting shriek. He bounded down the stairs and in the kitchen saw his wife standing aghast, her whole body visibly shaking.
Geraldine! Geraldine! Jesus, what happened?
Tony! I thought it was you, Tony.
You thought what was me, love?
It was here, Tony. Whatever it is, it was right here in our kitchen.
What was here?
It put its bloody hand on me. I felt a hand on my shoulder, Tony. Clear as day. I thought it was you. And that when I turned around, it got so cold, Tony.
Next day, the husband told a friend at work about the strange happenings in the house. The colleague produced a blessed medal and advised him to keep it somewhere safe in the house at all times. Tony was not convinced it would help, but reasoned it could do no harm. On returning home after work, he placed the medal on a shelf on a wall unit in the sitting room. Later that evening, the couple were relaxing together, watching television. They heard a strange rattling noise over by the wall unit, and as they looked, they saw the medal cannon violently off the back of the unit, as if someone had picked it up and thrown it forcefully against it. Shaken and unnerved, they decided something had to be done to end this affliction. A few days later, at the couple's request, a priest called to the house to perform a blessing. He began reciting prayers as he walked through the house, blessing and praying in every room in turn.
Father, thank you so much for coming.
Of course, Geraldine. It's all part of the job.
So, is it gone now?
I can assure you, you won't be having any more trouble here.
So what was it? Did you feel something, like a presence?
There's no need for that kind of talk there. go get yourselves some rest.
We will, Father.
But I will say this. You're not the first in this town to have experienced the likes of this. And you certainly won't be the last.
And on that note, the priest left and the couple were never troubled again. Ominously, however, from the priest's assertion, it is quite possible that someone, somewhere in Derry, may well be experiencing their own nightmare ordeal at this very moment.
The Parade of Phantoms audiobook, Story 4. The Insidious Intruder, narrated by Pat Lynch and Shauna Losby.
I wait impatiently for morning, so to sleep. For through all the darkness of night I do weep. For in the darkness and shadows control the mind, and the most fearful things it is then sure to find. J.M. Coyle. The notion of an unseen presence brooding malevolently in some dark, secluded recess, eagerly awaiting an unsuspecting victim, conjures up perhaps the ultimate nightmare scenario. Unfortunately for one young Derry couple, Anne and Tom, the nightmare was all too real. The following events occurred in the Glen Owen area of the city. Practically from the instant she set foot in the flat, Anne felt vaguely uneasy.
I have a strange feeling about this place. There's something not right here.
Ach, that's silly talk. Moving into a new place can feel strange. It's normal, but you'll soon settle in.
However, Anne's apprehension grew irrationally to Tom's mind over the next few weeks, and then it started. One night Anne was rudely awakened by a deliberate and repeated tugging at her hair.
Ow! Ow! What the... Wake up, Tom! Wake up!
What? What's wrong?
My hair! Something's been pulling on my hair! It hurt!
Oh, well, it wasn't me. You probably cut your hair beneath my arm and tried to pull it free in your sleep.
But Anne was far from convinced by Tom's drowsy explanation. She sensed a sinister hand at work, and indeed her worst fears were soon confirmed. The night-time hair-tugging recurred intermittently in the ensuing weeks, with intensifying maliciousness. On each occasion, Tom was asleep, oblivious to her torment. However, he too was soon to sample the ominous force at work. At around 6 o'clock one morning, the slumbering pair were painfully roused. Grabbed viciously by the hair, Tom's head was wrenched backwards and held rigid against his pillow. Anne's hair was simultaneously seized and yanked upwards, jolting her head off her pillow. The couple stared at each other, incredulous, fear numbing the pain. The assault ceased unceremoniously, and they lay stunned and speechless until Anne pleadingly ventured.
Oh God, what are we going to do?
The ensuing silence reflected their acute sense of helplessness. Anne later spoke apprehensively about the experience.
It was as if somebody had reached up through the mattress, through the pillows, and gripped Tom's hair and was trying to pull him down into the bed while my hair was being pulled upwards, my head held suspended above the pillows. After that night, I tried all sorts of rituals, like sprinkling blessed salt, rubbing holy oil on myself, and actually blessing the flat and summoning the spirit to leave. At that time, I just couldn't find anybody who was an expert in the field and could do anything to help. Then, things started to get much worse.
Not long after, Anne went to bed early one night while Tom stayed on in the sitting room to watch television. Before getting into bed, she made sure the adjoining door was left slightly ajar. Eventually, Anne started to doze and at some stage felt what she assumed to be Tom getting in beside her. An arm slipped snugly under her shoulder. Another encircled her waist, hugging her comfortingly, lulling her to sleep. Suddenly, the icy strangeness of the embrace struck like a thunderbolt, wrenching her from a verge of slumber. She turned her head slowly in dreaded anticipation, her heart pounding. Empty. There was no one there. Yet she could still feel the unseen arms about her, clasping her tightly. Instantly, her eyes darted to the open door. Tom was languishing on the settee, still watching television. The numbing, nauseating horror registered, and Anne screamed in sheer, abject terror. She bolted upright, free of the loathsome clutches, and fled to the sitting room. Tom jumped to his feet. "Anne, what's happened to UK?" Anne grasped Tom tightly, shaking, sobbing, stuttering.
Something had its arms around me.
Hey, I'm here. It's okay. You're safe now.
However, it was by now apparent to both of them that the bedroom was the focal point of the menacing ministrations. And after such harrowing experiences, sleeping arrangements became a decidedly guarded concern. Anne later explained,
"I was finding it quite hard to get to sleep and had to get Tom to put his legs and arms over me so that I could feel protected."
Cocooned in his limbs, she relished her newfound nightly solace. The spiteful spirit, alas, was not so easily thwarted, and Tom now bore the brunt of its pernicious attacks. Bruises regularly appeared on his arms and legs. Deeply etched scratches crisscrossed his back, and on one particular occasion he awoke with a raw wound gouged on his forehead. Anne recalled,
"It looked terrible, as if someone had burrowed the finger right into his forehead."
The entity's war of attrition was taking its toll. Apart from dressing in the bedroom during daylight hours, the couple now avoided it and retreated to the sanctuary of the other rooms. However, their respite was brief. One evening, Anne was in the kitchen preparing a meal. Tom was in the sitting room engrossed in a challenging game of computer chess. As she reached for a dish in an overhead cupboard, she felt two arms creep around her waist. She froze. For an instant, she thought, hoped, prayed it was Tom. She cast her eyes downwards. Tom shuddered. Anne's piercing scream meant only one thing. Their insidious intruder had ventured forth from its bedroom lair. A new and odious phenomenon soon followed. On returning home, the couple were often greeted by a pervasive, sickening stench, the source of which defied all investigation. On each occasion, the fetid smell cleared completely in a matter of minutes. It took one final, violent incident to spark their determined departure from the premises. One morning, Tom left for work before Anne. She went into the bedroom to find something to wear. She was anxious to get out quickly. Just as she found what she was looking for, she was viciously thumped. Her sense of overwhelming despair is evident in her closing remarks.
"I got punched in the shoulder. It was like an electric shock. It went through my shoulder, right into my hip, and that pain stayed with me all day. It was horrible. Both of us were as low as we could possibly be. And sometimes in the middle of the night, I'd wake up and feel I just couldn't take it any longer. I'd get up and drive to my sister's house and try and get some rest. And if I wasn't in the flat, the spirit never seemed to bother Tom. It was obvious it had attached itself to me. I was frantic at that time. We'd been there a total of about 6 months. 6 months of constant fear. Eventually we left, and I'm happy to say it didn't leave with us.
The Parade of Phantoms audiobook. Story 5. Shantalo, the Old Land. Narrated by Pat Lynch and Shauna Losby.
My utterance is mighty. I am more powerful than the ghosts. May they have no power over me. Egyptian Book of the Dead, 3500 BC. Prior to the onslaught of urbanization, Shantalo, Shantalu, meaning old land or old cultivated land in Irish, hosted a relatively small number of households amidst its sprawling rural landscape. Such rustic isolation helped spawn and nurture, indeed cultivate, a rich array of local ghost lore. Some fragmented tales persist. A few hint of a phantom carriage trundling nightly through the grounds of a country estate once located at Belmont. Others allude to spirit voices luring young children to perilous streams. And a number mention a mysterious ball of fire appearing and vanishing along the racecourse road. Fortunately, at least one intact story has survived. It was recounted by a former lady resident of the old, old land and recalls a childhood experience stretching back over half a century.
I must have been about 8 or 9 when we moved to our new house in Shantalo. Down near where the Cairnhill roundabout is now, near Moss Road. We were so lured with the big new house, and my sisters and me had a big bed in the back room. The boys were in the same room, in their big new bed. There wasn't much else in the room, except for a wooden chest for our clothes that sat under the bedroom window, facing the beds. One night, we were all in bed. My mammy used to put us up early, but we were nowhere near ready for sleep. We were messing and telling jokes when all of a sudden I noticed something weird at the clothes chest. The rest of them stopped their carry-on and they too saw the figure gradually appear out of thin air and rise up out of the chest. It was the most beautiful wee girl. She had long fair hair and she came towards the beds, her hands held out. I bit a hole in the blanket I had just pulled over my head and looked through. The little girl was at the foot of my brother's bed and we all started squealing. We lay petrified until someone got the nerve to check if she'd gone. When we told my mommy and daddy, they laughed and said it was all a bad dream. The wee girl kept coming back on other nights. Sure, she meant no harm, and we accepted her as part of our bedtime routine. Sometimes when we were lying down, we could see right out through the roof and always see the moon shining. It could be teeming with rain outside, but we'd always see the moon shining and we'd shout, "Come on quickly, Daddy, and see! There's the moon again tonight! You can see it through the hole in the roof!" But when he would come in, the hole just closed up.
The incidents continued right up to the family's eventual departure from the house. But it wasn't until quite a few years later that a chance conversation yielded a startling explanation. One of the woman's sisters was dating a young man at the time, and in the course of an evening out, she happened to mention the story of the house. Her date was visibly taken aback, and he quizzed her in detail about the events and the address of the house, before solemnly announcing that wee girl was his cousin. the sorrowful tale unfolded. A daughter of the family who had lived there prior to them had been playfully swinging from a tree at the side of the house late one evening. A sudden gust of wind tore a slate off the roof. It plummeted, lethally striking the little girl on the head and embedding in her skull. There wasn't anything anyone could do. She was carried to the upstairs back bedroom and laid on her bed beside the window. She died that night, a waxing moon bathing the tragic scene. The woman reflected on her tale.
It's funny how the story came around after so many years. That gap we saw, that must have been where the slate was that flew off and killed her. And that must have been the wee one's ghost coming back. She wouldn't have come back to my mother and father. It was children she wanted to be with. She probably had brothers and sisters, and they would have been in that room too, just like us. I visited the area recently. There are so many houses now. I was a bit unsure just where exactly we used to live. But I do know that when we lived there, there was always talk of ghosts and voices and what have you. Everybody had their own story. I often wonder if any of the people living there now ever see the things we saw.
The Parade of Phantoms audiobook. Story 6. Shocking Results. Narrated by Pat Lynch, Micheál MacDaid, Tiernan McCartney and Seanan Lusby.
O pity the dead that are dead, but cannot make the journey. Still they moan and beat against the silvery adamant walls of life's exclusive city. D. H. Lawrence. Accommodation for students at Ulster University's McGee College campus in Derry is a perennial problem, with many experiencing difficulty finding suitable lodgings. A number of years ago, an unfortunate few had some particularly disturbing experiences relating to their chosen haven. Two students from Armagh, Dave and Shan, were pleased to have found accommodation less than 10 minutes' walk from the university. They had to share one large room on the first floor of the house with two beds. On the top floor, directly above their room, was another large bedroom which was unoccupied. A bathroom, kitchen and separate sitting room were located on the ground floor. When first asking around for accommodation, the boys had heard rumours of eerie goings-on in the house in the past, but laughed them off as just that, rumours. A few weeks into the new term, however, Dave had the dubious honour of being the first to sample a precursor of the sinister events the house had in store for its new guests. One night he witnessed a shadowy black figure moving about his bedroom. In the dim light it appeared to glide effortlessly along the foot of the beds. It stalled at each in turn, paused and then disappeared into a dark obscured recess of the room. Dave resolutely ascribed it to his sleepy imagination. He didn't mention it to anyone, and for the remainder of the term, nothing further untoward happened. In the new year, Dave and Shan returned to the house, and a friend of theirs from home, Bridget, moved into the top floor bedroom. In hindsight, the students believe her arrival in the room may well have been the trigger that unleashed the fearful chain of events which followed. They found Bridget alone in the kitchen one morning. She looked upset and dishevelled, and they noticed she was shaking. Concerned, Dave gently inquired.
Are you okay, Bridget? Is anything wrong?
Yes. Yes. I had a terrible night. It was terrifying. I was alone, fast asleep. It was really late. Then I heard it. Coarse, heavy breathing, close by the bed. I thought I was dreaming. I thought I was having a nightmare. Then the sound changed. It was like a strangulated groan. It was grotesque. It didn't last long and stopped really suddenly. When I looked up, I saw a cowl-clad figure, like a monk, with a rope around its neck. It was standing right over my bed. I'm too scared to sleep alone in that room tonight, boys.
Come on, I'm sure it was just a bad dream, Bridget. But look, you should bring your stuff down to our room. Use the sofa bed tonight.
Bridget accepted the offer, and all three slept in the room that night. At about 5:30 in the morning, Dave's peaceful slumbering was interrupted by Shan's urgent pleading.
Dave, turn on the light. For God's sake, turn on the light.
Dave hurried to the far end of the room and switched on the light. Shan and Bridget were sitting upright on their beds, wide-eyed and noticeably trembling. Dave anxiously asked what had happened. When they had gathered themselves, they explained both had felt a heavy, immovable weight at the bottom of their respective beds. For a frightening few seconds, their legs were pinned down, but they could see no one. Dave reacted in shock.
Does that mean I actually walked right past where that thing had been? If I had known that, I never would have gotten out of bed.
Next night was Ragball Night, a highlight of the student social calendar. The three friends went to the ball. However, only Shan and Dave returned. Bridget deliberately stayed elsewhere. At around the same time as the previous morning, 5:30, Shan again wakened Dave. He was standing by the light switch, quaking, his face gaunt and lurid. When he eventually came round, Shan nervously recounted the incident.
Something woke me, and I saw a shape standing beside my bed. It was about 5 feet tall and had a kind of white hood pulled down over its face. I could make out its sharp nose and chin, and it was holding something in its right hand, like a small white cloth. I just stared at it in shock. I looked away for just a moment, and when I looked back, it had gone. I can tell you, it was really scary.
Still visibly shaken, Shan went home to her ma the next day, and Dave, not wanting to be alone, persuaded Bridget to stay and invited another friend, Steve, to spend the night in the house with them. Too anxious to sleep, they sat up in the bedroom and chatted distractedly. Late in the night, Dave realised he needed to top up the electricity meter. He wasn't going alone. The intrepid trio trudged warily down the stairs, and just as the top-up was complete, all the lights went out. Pandemonium erupted. Steve was all for running into the street there and then, but sense prevailed. They hastily recovered their shoes before fleeing in complete panic. They all stayed in Steve's that night. Returning the next day, all seemed to be well, and for the next few days the house remained normal. On Shan's return, they decided to have a party in the house, and students being students, six people ended up sprawled sleeping in the first floor bedroom. Ominously, again at precisely 5:30 a.m., Dave saw each of the others suddenly wakened for a few seconds in various trance-like states before resuming their deep sleep. It was a reminder that it was still there. Dave was convinced their ordeal was far from over. Quite likely the worst was yet to come. Neither Shan nor Bridget could remember waking up in the middle of the night. But after some discussion, they unanimously decided it was time to leave. By the end of the week, everyone had moved out and the empty house stood invitingly silent, patiently awaiting the arrival of the next unsuspecting guests.
The Parade of Phantoms audiobook. Story 7. Bizarre Occurrence in Bishop Street. Narrated by Pat Lynch.
Do I believe in ghosts? No, but I am afraid of them. Marquise de Defont. The eerie experiences of one local man are clearly and cogently conveyed in his own words in the story following. They occurred while he was living and working in his family's pub, Mickey Lynch's, a well-known hostelry which once graced Lower Bishop Street. This story starts for me years ago in 1966. I had just moved from one bedroom in the house to another, as my older brother had gone to London to work. There was nothing unusual about this, nor were there any tales or stories about this particular bedroom. Everything was just normal in a normal household, as I thought. Shortly after moving into the bedroom, a very strange and, at the time, very frightening thing happened. One morning, I awoke to find a figure standing at my bedroom door, a female figure. At first I thought it was my sister, but after rubbing the sleep from my eyes, I could clearly see there was no resemblance at all. It was a young woman, I guessed in her early 20s. She wore a long tweed coat and colourful silk headscarf. She stood absolutely still, her face gaunt and expressionless. My initial reaction was that of fear and utter disbelief in what I was seeing. I began to think I had not wakened and rubbed my eyes again, but she was still there. Then, to my horror, she began to move towards the bed, not walking, but with an effortless motion as if she was floating. I jolted upright in the bed, still thinking, hoping it was all a dream. But she continued her slow and seemingly menacing approach. She stopped at arm's length and looked directly at me. I saw a faint smile on an otherwise sad face. I seemed to lose my fear at that stage, wondering instead why she was sad. Had something terrible happened to her? What did she want? In fact, I was quite content about the whole situation. Then she started to fade before my eyes, gradually becoming transparent until she simply disappeared. Three similar manifestations occurred at approximately 3 yearly intervals then. As inexplicably as they had begun, they ceased. The questions remained unanswered. A decade of normality followed. Redevelopment plans for the area were sanctioned and the pub was duly demolished. However, one harrowing episode was to precede its final demise. I had since got married and moved out. My mother had also bought a house, so the premises were no longer lived in. I often worked late in the pub and because I didn't drive, I relied on taxis to get home. Normally, a friend would call before the last customers left and we would sit and have a few drinks until my taxi arrived. On this particular night, however, I was on my own. As usual, I locked all the doors, with the exception of the front door. I sat down by the window and waited for my taxi. Directly opposite me was the last door I had locked. It led to the bedrooms at the top of the house, and there's no question about it, I had definitely locked it. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning and very quiet. I heard the sound of a car approaching and assuming it was the taxi, I stood up on the seat, parted the curtains and looked out. I was surprised there was no car anywhere to be seen. That part of the street was long and straight and I had a good clear view in either direction. I know I heard a car. I checked again and at that precise moment, the locked door leading to the bedrooms burst violently open. Instantly, before I could even turn around, I felt a hand grasp me forcibly on the shoulder. The grip was vice-like, excruciating. Every hair on my body stood up. I was abruptly released and the door slammed shut with a thunderous echo. I gasped in relief, but remained frozen to the spot for what seemed like an eternity. Eventually, I was able to move and bolted out into the street, pulling the front door shut behind me. I can tell you I was glad to get out. Some distance up the road, a few women I knew were standing chatting. It wasn't unusual, even at that time of the morning. I made my way up and was greeted with the words, "What's wrong with you? You look terrible." I told them the story. The next morning, I went back to the bar. The door leading to the bedrooms was indeed locked. I went up to my old room and just stood there for a few minutes. I didn't feel afraid. I told the story to a few old-timers who had come into the bar. One of them informed me that, curiously enough, my mother had been upstairs the day before and took an old picture from one of the bedrooms up to her new house. The picture in question was a Nikon-style portrait, hand-woven in gold thread, possibly quite valuable. It had been there when my parents bought the house 50 years previously. I can't logically explain it, but I knew there was a connection with its removal and the incident the night before. I phoned my mother and told her the story. She was more than happy to bring back the picture. It was bulldozed along with the bar. Thankfully, I've had no similar experiences since that night.